Welcome to This Is Money in partnership with NS&I. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining editor Simon Lambert and I today is assistant editor Lee Boyce. And coming up, sleepwalking into a mega mis-selling scandal, a saver's getting the right advice about final salary pensions. Also today, hidden treasure from shillings to pounds, a reader discovers an old post office savings bank book from the 60s. But what's it worth now, and can you even take the money out? Also, premium bonds, how do you really find out you've won the jackpot? Britain has a net zero emissions target for 2050, but what are the best electric cars to buy now? And forget fantasy football, This Is Money have a far better game for you to play that could bag you 20 grand. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I. Giving your little ones a head start with our junior ISA.
But first, there is deep and growing concern about the financial advice around final salary pensions. Two-thirds of savers are being told to abandon them, despite the fact that the standpoint from which advisers are meant to start is that this is not suitable. Now, despite repeatedly making this clear and strengthening the rules on transfers, the FCA says too much advice is still not of an acceptable standard. However, in response, the influential MP, Frank Field, warned it's the watchdogs themselves who are sleepwalking into another mega mis-selling scandal. So first, a quick explainer, if you would. Final salary, why are they so good? Why are they called golden and all that, Simon?
Well, to indulge in a little piece of pensions jargon for a minute, I hope that all of our listeners will forgive me. And I hope that you'll forgive me too, George.
Yes, okay. You're allowed, Simon.
So there are two types of pension, a defined benefit pension and a defined contribution pension. And before the shutters come down, I'll tell you why this matters. Okay. So basically, the defined benefit is that the benefit of the pension is defined for you. So you work for a company or an organisation, you still get these in the public sector. You very rarely get the ability to get extra years of these in the private sector now. You work for a company, and for each year that you work for them, they promise to pay you a percentage of your final salary. That's your salary on the day you retire in retirement for the rest of your life until you die. And they also invariably promise to pay your spouse perhaps 50%, perhaps even more when you die, if they survive you. And it might be that it's based on a final salary. They traditionally were, which is why they're called final salary pensions. Or more commonly nowadays, some of them have shifted to something called career average. So it's an average of your salary over your career, because obviously your salary when you retire is going to tend to be higher at a company because you'll have had many years of pay rises. And the reason why they're called defined benefit is because the benefit is defined. You know what you're going to get. The risk lies on the company or the organisation. They have made a promise to pay you that, and they have to stick by that promise. The only way they can wriggle out of it is by going bust. And even if they do go bust, it's quite hard for them to wriggle out of it. And there is a pensions lifeboat that will come in and help you out. You might not get every penny that you were promised, but you will certainly get the lion's share of it. And these are referred to sometimes as gold-plated pensions. They're basically the best you can get because someone else is taking all the risk for you.
Yeah.
You also have a defined contribution pension. Now, this is where the contribution is defined rather than the benefit. And here, you pay some money in, your employer pays some money in, it goes into a pot, you invest the pot over the years. At the end of all that time, when you come to retire, you have a hopefully larger pot of money, you will have a larger pot of money, and you then have to use that to fund your own retirement, be that through keeping it invested, be that through buying a product called an annuity, which then gives you a guaranteed income for the rest of your life, but are not particularly great value, or through a combination of them all, or you could even just take it all out as cash. That's not advisable. But the problem there is that whilst the contribution is defined, i.e. what you put in or what your employer puts in, all of the risk lies with you, the investment risk you're taking in, how much that pot grows over the years. You could get super lucky. You could get another 20, you could get 20 years of stock market rises. You could get very unlucky. You could get 20 years of the stock market being in the doldrums. The problem with defined contribution pensions Is that the problem with defined benefit contributions? Is at the other end, it's the company taking all that risk for you. They've got to have a pot of money, which means that they can pay all this. They've got to take the investment risk and so on. So final salary pensions are expensive. They have been closed down by many companies over the years. But there are people who still have them. And there are companies and organisations that have been trying to encourage people to move out of said pensions because they are expensive for them.
So you can see the benefits to a company to getting essentially people off their books that way. But yeah, why would it be of benefit to someone to abandon this? There must be a lot of carrot, I suppose.
So firstly, anybody with a final salary pension or any form of defined benefit pension should be very careful about giving it up. The first reason I would give for that is if somebody else is on the hook for providing you with a certain amount of money, or a certain payment, and they'd like you to give it up, you should be very cautious about giving it up, because there's probably a very good reason why they'd like you to give it up, and that's probably because it's very good. Mm. Why would you do it? Well, it might be that you've got other pension built up elsewhere. It might be that you're confident you've already got enough money to fund your retirement. It might be that it's a small chunk of your retirement savings and you've got plenty elsewhere.
Some more control.
It might be that you have some form of disease or illness that will limit your life. You're in poor health, and so you don't think that you're actually going to get it all back. Or it might just be the fact that companies are offering people whacking great sums of money in order to get them out of these. So huge multiples. So we're talking lottery winner style amounts of money. We are talking payouts in the hundreds of thousands of pounds, and in some cases in the millions. Some people could basically get more than £1 million from a company in order to walk away from their final salary pension. Now, it's important to note that you will not get that £1 million in cash in your bank account. You will get that £1 million into a defined contribution pension. You would then have to take it out of there, and there then would be a hefty tax bill if you tried to take all of it out. Rules apply. But once you're over the age of 55, you could theoretically take all of that money out. You will pay 45% tax on most of it, though. But the reason why is because people are being tempted by these huge sums of money, and also you have to have financial advice to do this, but there is a big question over some of the financial advice.
Well, exactly. And, you know, Lee, there's lots of reasons why people may want to do this, but they also may be being advised to do this, which is what looking at these stats initially on face value seem to imply, that 2/3 of savers are being told to abandon their final salary pensions. Dig into that a little bit more.
Well, so basically, if you anything over £30,000 in the pension pot, you have to take financial advice, which obviously means there's a number of advisors, etc., out there. And of course, as we always say on this show, there is a varying level of advice, as in there's good eggs and there's bad eggs, right? And what the FCA are looking at from this perspective is basically to put a stop at inappropriate advice. So there's a lot of inappropriate advice out there. I mean, you're meant to be starting from a standpoint in which it's probably going to be a benefit for you to stay in your final salary pension. Now, that's not always the case. It's a very complex decision, hence why you have to go and get some financial advice. But for the FCA, it is a worry when we're talking about, you know, the average pot being over £300,000 that's being advised upon, and the kind of fees that some of these advisors may be charging.
Is that it? So what's in it for the financial advisor? Is it the fees? Is it that they can put it into their own sort of fund?
There was a bit of both, Georgie. Right? Yeah. So, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, they can get this money then put into a fund. And the thing is with that is that you are then exposed more to the stock market and to potential investment risk and decisions that might not be appropriate for you, whereas when you're into a final salary pension, you're more likely to have your money protected, especially against things like inflation. It's more long-term security and having the money there. Again, it's not a one-size-fits-all. That's the thing. You know, that's why you do need to get financial advice when it comes to these matters. But I think that the FCA is worried that there's a number of companies out there that are perhaps giving inappropriate advice. People may be making decisions a little bit, sort of having their judgment skewed by advisors that are in it basically to make some money. Now, that's a very sweeping statement, but as I said at the beginning of what I was just saying, is good eggs and bad eggs, and that's the worry. I think that's keeping someone up at the FCA up at night.
Yeah, I imagine so. But it may sound a daft question. Can't we have some rules that say that you are only allowed to give advice on this subject if you stand to gain nothing ever from this person.
No, that's like asking people to do work for free, though, George, isn't
it? No, no, you pay them for independent financial advice. This is a one-off fee or whatever, but they cannot then have your money in any of their products or services.
And that's a very good point. And I think we touched on this recently, but Tanya Jeffries, our pension reporter, did a really good story about if you want one-off advice, how you go about getting it and how much you should be paying and what you should be asking. Because the thing is, if you don't make it quite clear that you're just after one-off advice, there is a danger in which advisors start, you know, wanting to basically take over your financial matters and start doing lots and bits and pieces and talk you into it. These people were, again, I don't want to sort of make sweeping statements about every single financial advisor because there are good financial advisors out there, but there are some unscrupulous ones. And I think people are having their heads turned perhaps by these big sums that are being mentioned. As Simon says, a lot of companies want these final salary pensions off their books because they are expensive. And that is causing a recipe, as Field said in his comment, of a big mis-selling scandal looming, where people, the stock market has been kind of bubbling along quite nicely. But if we see a sort of downturn or a dip, that's when people start noticing those pots going down a bit, for example, and that's when more questions might start being asked. And we look at this whole Neil Woodford thing from the last, we would never have predicted that probably 2 years ago. And now we're seeing that now. There's lots of elements to this, but I think when you're talking about an average typical sum of over £300,000, it's such a life-changing sum of money that people are putting into advisors' hands. And it isn't always easy to find a very good advisor. It's not the easiest task, in my opinion.
Indeed. Clearly there's issues there, Lee. Clearly there's concerns. MPs are concerned. The FCA is concerned. But is there an argument that perhaps this two-thirds of savers figure is a bit misleading in the fact that, you know, as you both pointed out, you have to pay for financial advice over a certain amount of money that you have in your pension, but those people who are going to get advice about it may already be the ones who are quite engaged, have an idea of what they want to do with it, and so therefore they will have almost asked for this in a way.
Yeah, so you could top slice this and take a chunk of people involved in this who are going to financial advisors and asking for this advice. And they're going to financial advisors and getting this advice because they've already decided that actually they want to swap their final salary pension for a sum of money. For the reasons I gave earlier, it might be that it's a small chunk of their retirement savings. They've got plenty elsewhere. Various other reasons, they might be in poor health and so on. So it's going to skew towards them, and actually they're using the advisor to facilitate it. In fact, we've had cases before from people who don't want financial advice. They say, I know exactly what I want to do and it's my money. Why can't I get it without paying a financial advisor? And then the advisor has to do their work, and the advisor might discourage them, and they say, no, we want to do it. And then there's a question for the advisor as to what do you do? There are some companies who say that if they've given people advice not to do something and then the person says, I still want to do it, they won't let them do it. They won't facilitate it. They'll say, no, you're going to have to go find someone else.
Yeah.
Advisors are quite careful about this. However, underlying this, there are some large-scale instances where companies have tried to buy people out. One of the famous ones was British Steel, and there was the chicken dinner meetings where basically the advisors were going in, swooping in, leafleting people, saying, come and get a free chicken dinner, chicken and chips, chicken in a basket, I think it was. And then a financial advisor would stand up, talk to you, explain your options and things like that. And there were companies who were offering no transfer, no fee deals. So they'd give you advice, and if you didn't transfer, then you wouldn't pay anything. You'd only pay if you transferred. Now, you can see there's an obvious incentive there for the advisor to get someone to transfer, can't you? Because if they don't transfer, they don't get paid. And you only need a few bad apples within the advice scenario. And actually, most advisors are very sensible about this. Most advisors are not bad apples. But you only need a few to start causing a bit of a problem. And, you know, there is even an issue for those who aren't advised badly and don't fall into this trap, that once they take that money out of their final salary pension and they put it into their defined contribution pension, they're then responsible for it and they've got to make it last. The advisor, you know, the advisor might get signed up to it on a kind of fit, help manage the money over the years kind of basis and everything like that. But they could just cancel that at any time. They don't have to use the advisor. They don't have to pay. They don't even have to pay attention to what the advisor says once they've got the money. They can just take the money out, and they might run out of money before the end of their retirement. It might be very easy to spend all that cash, or they might do something very tax unfriendly, because the money you take from your pension is added to your income. If you start trying to take out £100,000, you'll be judged to have £100,000 worth of income in that year, and you'll be paying 40% tax on a lot of it. If you try and take out a couple of £100,000, then you're going to be busting yourself over the 45% tax bracket. There is an argument that people ultimately in some of these scenarios need protecting from themselves.
Okay, well, how do we protect people from themselves? Not that you're not an expert, Simon, and I'm quite happy just to have you discuss this and Lee, but on your website in this article, you have been speaking to the experts, and are they by and large telling you exactly what you've just told me?
Yes, they are. And what there's been is a plan to, the FCA says it plans to focus on financial advice firms where the risk of poor practice was highest to prevent consumer harm in the future. There's been calls for this no transfer, no fee scenario to be wiped out so that this can no longer happen. And I mean, Steve Cameron, who's a pensions director at Aegon, said, in an ideal world, individuals will be able to identify early on, with the help of guidance, whether it's worth their time and money seeking and paying for advice on whether or not to transfer. An effective triage facility would screen out most of those where it's clear they should stay in their scheme. We agree with the FCA that the majority of defined benefit scheme members would be better off staying put, but that doesn't mean that not transferring is the right outcome for the majority of people who proceed to the full advice process, particularly after an effective triage stage. So what that's saying is there needs to be a better filtering out process where people are helped to decide whether they should go to an advisor or not, and before they spend a couple of £1,000 on the advisor. Because actually, if you think about it, human nature says that if you've got to the point where you employ an advisor and you don't go down this no transfer, no fee route, and you pay the advisor a few thousand mm-hmm. pounds, and at the end of it, the advisor says you should just stay put, you can think, well, I could have stayed put spending a couple of £1,000. You know, I'm going to take the money out.
Yeah.
So, exactly.
I mean, Lee, you've spoken there about the bad apples. Mm. I guess the worry with things like this and stories like this is, firstly, I thought the FCA have tried really hard over the years to get rid of those bad apples, to try and encourage people who have major life decisions. And I perhaps I'm wrong, but I do think people have bigger decisions to make perhaps than in the past with our finances. But stories like this are just going to make people think, oh, I'm not going to bother now, because how can you guarantee you're going to get someone who's going to give you good advice and that's it, you're stuffed? Or you're in a situation where you've paid thousands of pounds just for someone to tell you status quo is fine.
Well, firstly, if you've got over 30 grand, you've got no choice because you have to. But
just generally, of any life decisions, though, not just this.
When we're saying about bad eggs, bad apples, whatever, we are talking about a very small percentage of financial advisors here. What the FCA are worried about is specifically this little slice of advice seems to be more ripe for bad advisors than other areas of the financial market. And what they're trying to do is make sure that the same standards are being adhered to as to other areas of the financial market. You're right. These are big decisions that people are having to make with vast sums of cash, you know, and as Frank Phil rightly points out, you know, we don't want a situation in people in which people's life savings, their money that they're going to have to live on for their retirement, and that could be for 10, 20, 30 years or beyond, is getting wiped away because of some bad advice that happened at the start of that process. So I think first and foremost, it's good that this conversation is happening and that the FCA are looking into it, but there needs to be more action, and there needs to be more action quicker. We were warned about this a couple of years ago, and it still feels like there's a lot of reporting coming out, but not enough action. It just feels a little bit like, well, come on, if you know this is happening, then you must have information as to where some of this is happening the most and steps to prevent it, and a more systematic approach into a good way for people to find the right advisor for them, someone that comes with a good track record, someone that is going to make the correct decisions for you. And again, I will reiterate this point, a lot of financial advisors, the vast majority of financial advisors will do that. There's just a few bad eggs, apples, that British Steel example being one of them. You know, that's just not acceptable. It's and the FCA are looking at a situation like that, and they're aware of it, but they're still not doing enough to ban that kind of practice, that kind of, you know, no fee if you don't transfer type advice, which I think is detrimental to consumer confidence. You know, people, as you rightly say, will read a story like this and go, oh God, I'm dreading getting financial advice, you know, when the time comes, because I'm reading stories like this and it all just sounds like the Wild West. You know, it's not quite like that. But I think the FCA is right to put a spotlight on this, but it just needs to act a bit faster, and it just needs to get some plans in motion to help protect people.
Just one final thing on this, Simon, in terms of consumer confidence and stuff that we're reading in the press. How much do you think that stories like BHS, like pension funds, pension lifeboats, all this sort of jazz, are impacting the way perhaps people feel about how safe their pension might be? A defined benefit pension, and whether they will get all that money, and maybe, you know, it might be better that they just whip it out.
Yeah, no, I think that's definitely a problem, because you read stories and you think things are worse than they are. It's human nature, isn't it? We read stories about all kinds of things that we think are worse than we are, ranging from our likelihood of being stabbed to the likelihood of a natural disaster affecting us, or the fact that Brexit is a mess. Oh, no, sorry, that last one is correct. No, it is true. And I think that most people should just be reassured that if they do have a final salary pension, their money is largely protected. There are scenarios where if the company goes bust and your pension goes into the pension lifeboat, then you actually can lose some of that pension that you're owed. And if you're owed a particularly big pension, then that is more of an issue for you. Once your pension is being paid, your final salary pension is being paid, then it should be completely safe. I think people worry about companies trying to do the dirty on them. I think people see stories like BHS and so on, but it is very hard for a company to wriggle out of its final salary pension obligations, as actually has been shown by situations like BHS. So if you are in that position and you are concerned about it, or you have a family member, parent perhaps, who's in that position, you are concerned about it, then look into it properly. Come to This Is Money. If you're really worried about it, email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk and we'll try and look into it.
All right then. All right, we're going to move on to happier subjects, because I really like this story. The idea of discovering childhood treasures. It's not the same, but I keep thinking of Amelie when she discovers that little box. you know, that sort of thing. But it could literally be that, hidden treasures. As one of your readers got in contact, after recently finding an old post office savings book from back when he was a wee lad, it records the princely sum of 10 shillings, a deposit made on the 24th of August in 1966, a very vintage year. What he wants to know, though, is, Lee, what is it worth today, and whether he could rock up at the post office and redeem it? But before we get to that, any more to tell us about this quaint tale? Were there marbles within the... No.
Oh, Georgie, you're old romantic.
I know, with French music playing in the background.
Just opening up a drawer, and there it was, of a layer of dust, and it hadn't been touched for 50 odd years.
Letters from his grandpa.
And yeah. He was suddenly a millionaire. And he thought, wow, what am I going to do the rest of my years? No, it's not quite like that. We actually get quite a few queries like this. I remember writing something a couple of years ago, something similar. Obviously, back in the day when savings books were more rife, I mean, even when we were children,
I remember mine,
you know, we had
yeah.
savings books. We don't tend to have as much of that now. We used to get a stamp in it when the money's gone in, etc. So this, in this case, he found his savings book from 1966. It was 10 shillings deposited shortly after England won the World Cup. So a lovely summer. Let's wind back to the summer of 1966, the midst of the swinging 60s.
Well, and, the two related. You know, did you get a bonus for
do you know what? One day there will be a scenario where we'll have to say, shortly after England first won the World
yeah,
Cup.
Well, yeah, wishful thinking. Probably by 2066.
Maybe this summer.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, yeah, maybe this summer. We all know what we're actually talking about.
Yeah, the Cricket World Cup. No, sorry, George. So anyway,
going back to
the case in point. So 10 shillings have gone into this account, and he just obviously had the book probably somewhere in some paperwork. Mm-hmm. A lot of us do that, just bury stuff and then find it years later and go, oh, yeah, I did have a bit of money in there. Found it, didn't really know how to track it down. It is actually quite difficult to track this kind of money down. You think, has it just been written off somewhere into the coffers and it's disappeared? If they did that for everyone in the country, it'd be probably quite a bit of surplus cash sloshing around, I would suggest. So we knew that in 1969, the post office, all of the post office savings accounts went over to NS&I, turned into NS&I in the late 60s. We know that because that's from the story that we'd written before. So we crunched the sums. We've got an inflation calculator, which is great fun on the website. You should definitely have a look on our inflation calculator. It's one that I find myself on at least once a month. I know there are some calculators like that, Georgie, that I do actually quite enjoy.
Inside your mind,
yeah.
Really.
It's also, well, I wonder what that was worth from that year. So we crunched it through, and from 1966, it crunched it at £9.50. That's how much it's worth. So he's not a millionaire.
£9.50.
But I'm afraid even then that's a little bit optimistic, and that's because of decimalisation in 1971. It's likely that 10 shillings was converted to 50p, and for that reason it would be more worth about £6.50.
Okay, but can he take it out though?
He can't.
Oh.
He can't go into he can't go to a post office, give his book over and go, "Oh, could you give me a cheque for 10 shillings please so I can go and buy a pint in Kensington?" No. He has to fill in a form. God, that's a really dull ending of the story, isn't it, Georgie? I'm really sorry. It involves form filling. So you have to contact NS&I. You have to complete a form with all the details that he holds on the account number, where it was opened, etc. And they'll track down the cash and they'll give him a neat little check for it, and he can cash it in and spend it how he likes.
I love stories like this. I absolutely love stories like this. The old savings book story has always been a massive winner. And you always like to think that the money hidden in that old savings book will be worth a small fortune, don't you? And then often it's quite disappointing.
Sorry.
I know. I've got an old savings book somewhere. It's my old Northern Rock ISA savings book. I've still got it in my desk drawer. I phoned them up the other day to try to find out how much it was worth. Unfortunately, the last approximation of what it was worth was in round about 2007, and interest rates have been on a bit of a downward trajectory since then, so it's not actually worth that much more. It's also now with Virgin Money, which obviously took over Northern Rock. And sadly, I was also told that the old savings book was not valid at all. That account number was not valid, and it had been moved years ago into a normal modern day Virgin Money account, and that they had actually sent me some statements for this, and I could just throw the savings book in the bin.
Meanwhile, talking of surprises, talking of NS&I, another dear reader has got in contact with a query about winning the £1 million premium bond jackpot. To be clear, alas, for them, they have not won it yet, but they remain ever hopeful. But they want to know that if they did, or when they do, or whatever, would they hear from Agent Million first coming and knocking at their door, or read about it in the press, and not about them specifically, privacy, blah, 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 but the area in which it was won, etc., etc. Who can reveal all on this one?
Agent Million can reveal all on this one.
There we go.
Yeah, exactly. So, your premium bond prize, first of the month. Mm. Agent Million will try to come round and tell you just before then. But what if you're away? What if you're on holiday? What if you discover from reading a story on This Is Money that the one of the £1 million premium bond prizes for this month was won by someone from London, an unnamed person from London? And you think, oh, perhaps that unnamed person from London could be me. And then you think, oh, but it won't be because Agent Million would have told me. And then you think, ooh, but I've been away. Could it be me?
Yeah.
Well, it could.
Could it?
Yeah, it could. It could be you. Agent Million will call on you to give you the good news on the day before all of this is announced. Agent Million works throughout the year, including weekends. So there wouldn't be any complications arising from the fact that, for example, the first working day of the month would fall on a Monday, because that's when it's announced. But there is a possibility where you might not be there. NS&I said, "We have always managed to contact our winners to give them the good news. However, it's important that customers keep their contact details up to date so that Agent Million can easily find them. There have been instances where the winner has not been home or they've moved house, and we've had to use other means to contact them before meeting them in person, which sometimes happens a few days later once the news has already been published."
Mm.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, where safer savings set you free.
Right, well, let's put to one side the debate debacle I think we can put it that way, over who will replace Theresa May as Prime Minister, as Tory leader, and focus a little bit on her legacy. I think that's what she would like as well. But don't worry, this is not about the B word, but the E word, environment. Now, she wants Britain to become the first major economy to put into law a net zero emissions target for 2050. So it looks likely the next 30 years we'll all be driving around, if you drive, of course, in electric vehicles. But what about now? Is it worth buying one now? What's the quality like? And when I say the quality, I mean the real world quality, not the lab test nonsense that we've been getting. Is it worth buying one? What car have been doing some tests? But first, Lee, just tell us a bit more about the target, how it's going to affect us, likely.
Well, yeah, this we've been having a few conversations in the office, Rob Hall and I, who's the author and our motoring correspondent, about the targets. And these targets about electric vehicles and all this sort of stuff, it's just really hard to get a grip on because it is just so far in the future. It's just so far ahead of time. It could, you could just say that, you know, someone that's not going to probably be around in 2050, yeah, we're going to do this by 2050. And I'm kind of a bit sceptical about it all. And I'm kind of, you know, we've obviously had this big drive in the last, especially in the last 2 years, about the environment and how important it is to recycle and to do things that are cutting down our carbon footprint, etc. And then we have a number of politicians that come out then with some targets that just feel so far away in the distance that I can't quite comprehend them. But that aside, there are rules being put in place that will be the first major economy to put into law a net zero emissions target for 2050. And a big part of that will be a push towards electric cars. We've seen the whole demonisation of diesel. We're talking about diesel and petrol cars not being available for sale from 2040, etc. And so we ask, what will we be driving? And how quickly will an electric revolution take place? We've also had London Mayor Sadiq Khan come out saying that London's going to need 50,000 charging points, for example, by 2025. That's just 6 years' time. And that's going to be like four times the number of what's out there now. So it's going to be a quick process in which we're going to need all of this infrastructure in place. I think that's the key. You put the infrastructure in place, more people will be keen to perhaps go electric. I think at the moment it's quite difficult unless you've got a driveway to charge your vehicle, for example. But then I would say the big market for electric vehicles are for people that live in the city, because they're probably more likely to do shorter miles. So what this what car testing does, and it does it with other cars as well, so they started doing an electric one after having years of sort of petrol and diesel versions. We all know that the official figures that manufacturers put out for how many miles per gallon a car can do is usually not that accurate, and the reason for that is that it's done in a lab and it's not really done under real world testing conditions, and that's what car sets out to do, and that's what it's done with this test, with the electric cars. But how many miles you can drive without running out of battery, which is the number one fear of anyone that perhaps wants to go over to electric, because there's a lot of talk about you know, cars don't have good enough battery for long enough miles, and you don't want to be someone that's broken down because you're batteries run out of charge. So they set out to kind of have a look at how big the gap is.
What they've done is they've looked at the range of these cars, which is interesting really, because when people pick electric cars, range, how far it will travel on a full charge, is one of the key things that they look at. But when you look at a normal car, nobody buys petrol or diesel cars based on how far they can go on a tank of petrol or diesel. They don't think about that. They think about all the other attributes of the car. Obviously, the key issue here is that it's much easier to find somewhere to refill your petrol or diesel car with petrol or diesel, so it becomes less of a question and less of an issue. And they've ranked the cars, and these range from some fairly puny ranges to some much more substantial ones. So, for example, the thing I'd say about electric car range, having driven a number of electric cars, and some of them over long distances, a Tesla all the way to Wales and back, is that actually, realistically, most people don't drive really long distances on a regular basis. It's highly unlikely that you're going to get in your car and drive 200 miles in any one go. Some people do that regularly. Those people are probably not suited to ownership of an electric car at the moment, unless they have access to fast chargers. But even then, they could probably do it, and they'd be the ones most likely to save the money on the fuel and save the environment a lot more by not using petrol or diesel. But most people, they probably average about 30 miles a day max in their car. A lot of people do much less than that. So you don't need to have a colossal range on the car. However, the Smart 4.4 EQ, the What Car Real range on this is 57 miles. You might want more than a 57-mile range. That said, if you're just driving around town, taking the kids to school or something, and you've got the ability to plug your Smart 4.4 EQ into a wall charger at home overnight and keep it charged up, it's probably a perfectly good little runabout. Probably couldn't use it as the main family car. The Volkswagen E-Op. Yes, E-Op. It's the Volkswagen Yorkshire, as it's otherwise known. Yeah. That has an official range of 83 miles, but What Car's real range is only 66. You might think that 66 miles is not a big enough range for a car. That starts from £19,000. We then move on to ones that have got slightly longer ones. The Hyundai Ioniq, official range 174, real range 117. The e-Golf, official range 186, real range 117. The Nissan Leaf, one of the UK's most popular electric cars. In fact, the best seller. Official range 168, real range 128. And what this reflects is that even in under the new testing system that is meant to deliver more of a reflection of real-world driving, it doesn't quite deliver real-world driving. I had a Tesla Model 3 for the weekend, a couple of weekends back on test. The first deliveries of that are coming now. It was a very good car. It did roughly 3/4 of the range that it said that you had. So you have something in the car that shows you the range, how far you've got left.
Yeah.
And then you've got how many miles you're actually covering. And that's going down about a sort of 3/4 ratio. So you if it says you've got 20, you actually only need to do about 16 miles to do that 20. Now, that depends on your driving style, but I wasn't driving with a particularly heavy right foot in order to do this. You can fiddle around with the car, actually, and get a more representative range based on your actual last half an hour's driving or so, and that is much more akin to what you're actually going to do. But realistically, this is not a problem because people worry about running out of range and grinding to a halt, and then there's no petrol station because it's not a petrol car, and it's much harder to find a charger, and then they've got to get someone out to rescue them. But you don't drive your car down to zero, a petrol car. When the light comes on, you fill it up. That's the equivalent of getting down to your last 50 miles of range in an electric car. Yes, I think some of the electric car makers do need to do better work in showing the range and what it actually reflects to in real life. But that is a similar problem when you look at MPG figures for petrol and diesel cars. And we just think about the two things differently. But to dip back in, the Renault Zoe, this is probably the pick of the bunch if you want a small, affordable electric car. These start from £17,000, but you can pick up a lot of them secondhand fairly cheap. Official range 186 miles, What Car range 146. We then move on to the expensive stuff. So we've got the Tesla Model S, the 75D. The official range on that, 259 miles, real range 204. The Jaguar I-Pace, one of the best electric cars out there. That's got an official range of 292, a real range of 253. And I think the pick of the bunch, if you want an electric car at the moment, for affordability and some very good reviews, is possibly the Kia e-Niro. That starts from £32,995. Official range 282, real range 253. But it is beaten to the punch, top of the list, the Hyundai Kona Electric, which interestingly is pretty much exactly the same car as a Kia e-Niro, but manages to go an extra 6 miles. Official range 279, real range 259.
So, Lee, I saw you were nodding along there, particularly to the Jaguar. In sum, with all of those figures and cars that Simon's mentioned then, if you are someone at the moment who is thinking about your next car, do you go for an electric car? And in reality, we talked there about petrol and there's lots of petrol stations around and da-da-da-da-da. Is there enough out there in terms of charging points, or are we reading too many, almost back to the scare stories we're reading in the press, right, again, where there's no charging points?
I think to answer your original question, it all depends on what kind of driver you are, right? If you're using it for long distances, perhaps you use it for business and you're driving around the country, I would suggest that it probably isn't the right fit for you. If you're someone that's doing fewer miles and nipping around the city or doing a short commute, yeah, I would say probably.
Do you think it's good enough now for just go for it? There's enough charging points, and don't worry about it.
I think the overriding issue that manufacturers have with electric cars at the moment is that whole thing about range. As Simon says, you don't buy a petrol car and think, oh yes, this 35 litre tank will do X amount of miles, and you know, no one lets it really run down to zero till you fill up. You know, you fill up probably when you've got 50 miles left in the car, and you kind of do the same thing with electric cars. The issue being is that the ranges are just quite a bit shorter than petrol cars, and that's the issue. If you had a light coming on for when 50 miles is coming down, it's probably going to be on quite a lot. So I think that the issue is people are worried that they're going to buy in at a moment when perhaps the way technology is moving so fast that we're on a cusp of a battery life that will do way more miles on a single charge as more manufacturers solely focus on electric vehicles. It will mean there'll be so much R&R going on to developing the next big fantastic battery that's going to, you know, probably change the game.
Do you mean R&D or R&R?
Research and development. Sorry, I meant R&D. Thanks for putting me up on that, George.
Sorry, yeah. I just thought
relax and recuperation.
That'd be amazing. Just chill out, guys. Don't worry about it.
The Homer Simpson style of designing a car.
I meant R&D.
Sorry. And I think it's that worry about buying in, and then, you know, as they become more mainstream, do the prices come down as well at the same time? Are there going to be more incentives to have charging points, you know, installed in your street, in your cul-de-sac, on your driveway, all of that kind of thing? I think it does put off people, but we're seeing a steady stream of people buying electric cars, and as they become more and more mainstream, I think they become more and more accessible to people, and I think it's only a market which we're going to see grow.
All right then, finally, have you ever thought you could be the next Neil Woodford? I appreciate that doesn't work so well at the moment, but if you always did fancy yourself as a bit of a stock market wizard, This Is Money is giving you the chance to find out, and you could win £20,000. Have a big that up. It sounds like a exciting competition. Pray tell us more, Simon. What's going on?
So we are celebrating This Is Money's 20th birthday.
Happy birthday.
Yes, our 20th birthday. It's this year. This Is Money was launched in 1999.
Wow.
And to do that, we have got a fantasy share picking game, and it is free to enter. You pick companies on the stock market to hold in your portfolio. If their share prices go up, then the performance is added to your portfolio. If their share prices go down, you can probably guess what happens then. It's taken off. The winner after 12 weeks will be the person with the highest aggregate score. There is a practice period running now. You can sign up now.
Oh, wow.
Go to thisismoney.co.uk/game. The actual game scoring starts properly on the 1st of July. If you've ever played fantasy football, then you should be able to get the idea and the gist of what's going on here. If you've never played fantasy football, that doesn't matter because it is relatively easy to play. We have tried to make it as simple as possible to play. If you have problems playing it, please get in touch and tell us. You can find all the details on our site. We have been beavering away to get this ready with the people who've built the game for us. We're doing it in partnership with Fidelity. And we are giving away £20,000. We are also giving away a £500 weekly prize for the top share pick of that week in the main prize league. So if you make a share pick that week and it goes up by the most, then you will win that £500 prize. A certain Mr. Boyce said, what happens when more than one people make the same pick? Now, obviously, it goes from the point when you bought it. And not everybody will buy the company at exactly the same time. So we're thinking that that should be all right. Obviously, if it's not all right, we will have to share that prize around.
Right, okay.
But we'll cross that bridge when we come to it, hey? But we think this is a really great way to celebrate This Is Money's 20th birthday. It's also a bit fun. Obviously, I should say here that investing is a long-term game. You need to be thinking in at least 3 to 5 years, preferably longer. Shares should not be bought for short periods of time. But this is a game. It is a bit of fun. We are not advocating investing over 3 months. And it is an insight into the world of share dealing.
Exactly,
it replicates it.
Nice.
You have the element of the bid and the ask prices of shares. So there's a spread in the middle. So if you're buying shares, it costs you a little bit more. Mm-hmm. Than if you're going to sell them, you get paid a little bit less. Its main company market, company shares, the FTSE All Share, and the AIM 100, which is the smaller caps, but not down to the tiddlers, all the really weird mining companies and stuff. We've filtered that out because they just are a little bit crazy to be playing the game with. And we think it will be fun. We will be sending out emails, updating people on the game. We'll be highlighting who's done best. We will be running some articles between now and the start of the game with some tips on how to do well. So as a little teaser into that, watch out for stuff that's tipped, share tips in the press, particularly Midas in Mail on Sunday. Look out for companies that have momentum. There is an element in that has been observed throughout the stock market where companies that have been doing well recently tend to keep doing well in the short term. And there will be more tips like that from us to come. But I would say go to thisismoney.co.uk/game, check it out, sign up, play the game. We'll be playing. We'll be clearly identifiable as us. So you can see if you can beat Neil Woodford. And even if you can beat Neil Woodford, which might not be that hard at the moment, you might probably also be able to beat us as well. And do you know what? If you've never invested before, you've never played the stock market before, you've never bought shares before, go and play. Because if you win, you can rightfully earn massive bragging rights over all the know-it-alls who'll be playing it too.
Yeah, I think so. But I tell you what, you know, forget clickbait to get people to come to their sites, Lee. Between the inflation calculator and this, we're never going to leave This Is Money, are we?
Well, that's the plan, Georgie. What do you mean? No, I mean, look,
drag us in. Get us never to leave.
You could use the inflation calculator to work out what the £20,000 price today would have been worth in 1999 money.
Right, that's it. I'm heading on there. And while I do, Simon, you can tell everyone how to keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news, how to get in contact.
Come to thisismoney.co.uk. Email us if you want to get in contact. editor@thisismoney.co.uk. Tweet us at thisismoney or come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all the podcasts past. Join in the comments and good luck with the game.
Good luck. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? Helps people find us.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving your little ones a head start with our junior ISA.